The following program has been brought to you by Rolling Press, a family-run, eco-friendly printing company. For more information, visit rollingpress.com.
I'm Grace Bonney of After the Jump, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, and welcome to the food scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here today with a little swag bag. First of all, thank you for that, because I was trying to will that to happen as much as possible. Nice. Without, like, I didn't want to infer too much, but the ladies of Ovenly, Agatha Kalaga and Aaron Patinkin, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And you are here because of many reasons.
Yes.
I love what you do. And I'm loving this cookbook.
Awesome. Wait,
there are temporary tattoos.
They're temporary tattoos.
That you're going to have to put on later.
Okay. I can just tell people we're on radio, so they're not going to be able to tell. Yeah. And that's like one of my biggest aversions.
So are you going to pretend?
Yeah. Oh, I'm putting on this great tattoo right now. Thank you.
Okay.
Fantastic. But this cookbook is, it's a triumph because of many reasons. You know, your business itself started in, what, 2009, conceptually?
Conceptually.
Yeah. Meeting at a food-focused book club. Tell me about what you were reading and why you kind of stopped reading and started dreaming.
Well, we were, both of us were in the book club for quite some time, but we never really went to the same meeting. And finally, I hosted one of the meetings at my house, and Agatha did come, and we were reading a book called Curry, A Tale of Cooks and Conquerors.
That I never read.
I read the whole thing because I can never not... I have to finish a book from start to finish. I can never just put it down. And it was about Indian cuisine and the history of Indian cuisine. It was actually very informative, but extraordinarily boring.
No one really liked the book.
But Agatha was inspired by the title and brought some pistachio cardamom cupcakes. And so that was kind of the recipe that sparked our conversation about food and baking and cooking together.
And we still sell them today, actually.
Excellent. So you had actually made those cupcakes. It wasn't like...
Yeah. It was my favorite recipe to bake at that time, and I felt like it was an appropriate event to do it for. And even though I hadn't read the book, I was excited to go. And I had heard about all of these great women going, and I showed up and...
Wait, was that your only meeting you went to?
I went to like one before, but...
I didn't realize that.
I was getting started. I was just getting started. And yeah, like Aaron said, we had a fun meeting and didn't talk much about the book and talked a lot about food. And
The whole group of women was... Besides Agatha and I, my college friend was also in the group, and she was a teacher, and she had been in publishing, and she had actually worked on some cookbooks, but most of the other people in the group in some way or another were professionally involved with food,
and we were not.
But it was really smart ladies, you know, lawyers working on food and environmental issues, chefs, restaurateurs, cookbook authors, food writers, and it was just a really smart group of ladies. Mm-hmm. And you know, conversations started being struck about starting a business, and you know, I remember everyone was kind of talking about it, and I was like, something happened, and I remember saying something like, well, I'm really surprised that there's not a business from this group of women. Everyone's so smart. And Agatha kind of stuck around and helped me clean up, and she, you know, came up to me, and she was like, I've been really thinking about starting a business for a long time. We should talk. And I was like, great, me too. Let's go meet for coffee. And a week later, we met for coffee.
And at that time, I had been doing a lot of baking on the side and wanting to do something, but I had a full-time career. I'd been working in psychiatry research for 10 years, and it was my pastime, but I did want to do something with it, and I wasn't really sure what. And when I met Aaron, I was like, this is the one. This is the one that I want to do this with. I had a couple friends that were really into baking, and none of them were as committed to the idea. They all, you know, talked about it and were excited about it, but once actually doing it came up, it sort of, they just took a step back. And when I brought it up with Aaron, and then we met a week later, and it was, that was it. We, like, Ovenly started a week later.
I like how you both praise each other's Eastern European work ethic in the book. But it's also that repertoire of baking that
really
shined.
Well, I think it was like
really
the immigrant work ethic.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
We're all from families of immigrants. And I think that, you know, we saw, you know, for me, it was my grandparents. And for Agatha, it was her parents. Just, you know.
Working their asses off.
Yeah. Yeah. Coming here with, you know, nothing and become, you know, and working their butts off until they were old to, you know, to provide for their families and leave something for their
but
families,
still so. Finding the time to bake.
Yes.
And
yes.
cook yeah. for their families. Oh, so, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, what were those memories? What were those recipes that have, you know, are of your legacy?
Well, for me, my father's parents lived in Florida, so I didn't see them as much, but actually his mother ran all of the bakeries and her family ran all the bakeries in Goldblatt's department stores in Chicago before she got married. And she actually was an amazing baker and used to send me, you know, brownies in the mail that were delicious. But my mother's mother was very involved in, you know, my upbringing, and some of my earliest memories are baking with her. And really the Eastern European things that I love were what she called kolachki, which I, when I made them for Agatha, I was like, this is not kolachki. But my grandmother was not Polish. She was from Serbia. But these little jam cookies that I actually looked up later that have a really long name that I can't pronounce. And then kiffle, which is like a walnut roll, and poppy seed roll. A lot of nut desserts and jam desserts. That was what we really had. It wasn't like chocolatey American no. stuff that I grew up in. I mean, there was a lot of that too, but that's not the stuff that she really made.
And I grew up with pretty much the same things, but a lot of punchki, which we were just talking about, a lot of prune jam and things, and I loved poppy seed. Everything was drenched in poppy, but it's not the poppy that you see today in desserts where it's sort of lightly sprinkled. It's like the dense poppy sort of jam where it's cooked down.
Yeah.
You actually boil it and it turns into a sort of paste. And so there was a like poppy filled rolls, as Aaron mentioned. And there was this one, I don't know if it's specifically Polish, but there's this apple cake that I specifically loved that my grandmother made and my mother made as well. And it was one of the things that I loved making with them. But those were, I think, my fondest memories. And there were a lot of currants and things. Currants are used in a lot of Polish desserts as well. And my grandmother had a garden full of them. So I was obsessed with currants.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I love how you're kind of exalting certain ingredients like poppy, like
yeah.
prune,
yeah.
which we'll talk more in depth about.
You mean dried plums.
Dried plums.
Dried plums.
Well, tell me a little bit about how you were able to sell prune-based desserts.
So Agatha and I just share a love of prunes. I love prunes. Prunes and chocolate is like one of my favorite combinations. But when we first started, we were like, well, we have to make prune desserts. And Agatha made these ponchki, which are filled with prune jam, and they're amazing. And we kind of, from the get-go, we were baking with fruits and spices. Like, that was always our thing. Or salt and sweet. Like, that's both what we liked. And right when we started Ovenly, we were making all these scones. And we did everything baker's choice for our clients. We had no menu. So we'd be like, well, we don't know. You've got a scone today. We don't know what the flavor is going to be. And so
You have to guess what it is. Yeah,
one of the things we came up with that we loved was a prune coconut scone. Oh, no, prune ginger. It was a prune candied ginger scone. Yeah. And it wasn't selling. And so we just changed the name to dried plum candy ginger. And then people were like, oh,
everyone
this is
loved
delicious.
It. Like, our clients wrote us back and they were like, this scone is so wonderful. They're just flying off the shelf.
Prune's got a bad rap in
the
80s
thing.
With all the prune juice. And
yeah.
Well, and it was related
that was,
to
it, that
old
was a
people.
bad marketing yeah. strategy.
I mean, do you feel like a lot of your desserts are harkening from a different age, like or throwback, or at least referring to those styles of pastries?
We like to do twists on traditional pastries. So a lot of what we do is classic, but with a twist. So it'll be a chocolate chip cookie, but there'll be a little twist to it. We add the Malden sea salt to it, and rock salt to it, and then we do like our currant rosemary scone, which is a traditional Scottish or British scone will have currants in it, and that rosemary just lends so much flavor to it and pairs really well with the currants. But we usually add a twist to more traditional things.
So I think one of the things about our pastries is that they are classic, but they're modern at the same time. And so everything we do, I really think all of our flavor combinations are really approachable. You know, we get comments like, oh, that sounds weird. You know, olive oil and pumpkin in pumpkin bread. But, you know, it's...
That's not that weird.
It's, no, it, no. Well, yeah, but people do think that's, yeah, like, that's something they've never heard of. And, you know, I think that we just... We're not doing things to be weird. You know, I think that's the thing. It's like we really enjoy playing with flavors, and we'll test things out until they work and they're delicious. So it's not like we're throwing things together just for the sake of having, you know, a new and interesting and surprising flavor. We want everything that we do to be approachable, but we want it to be surprising so you do come back. You know, we want people to try something and say, wow, that's really different. I've never tried that before, and I want more. Not like that's really different and really weird.
Yeah,
because that happens too. And we, you know, that's not our goal.
Already a runaway hit is the cheddar and mustard scone.
Oh yeah,
I've been seeing it kind of proliferate about. I mean, what was the concept behind that?
Well, we started. I think that I don't even know how we started. I know
it
was Anna Wolf. So it was my friend's mustard, right?
Yeah. So our friend Anna Wolf started. She had a mustard business, and she was making whole grain beer mustard.
And it was like mustard caviar. It was so good,
so phenomenal, and we were obsessed with it. So she gave us these jars, and we just kept eating it and trying to figure out what to do with it. And
I used to eat the stuff with a spoon.
It was so good, and so we were making. We were making a lot of scones, and as we still do today, and we decided to throw some mustard into the cheddar scone, and we also were using dry mustard for something. I don't know what.
I think we were just wanted to enhance the mustard flavor in the scone.
I know, dry mustard in the kitchen.
We had a lot of weird
things in the kitchen, and so we ended up adding that, and it was, I mean, it's still one of my favorite scones today. It, you know, it has like a nice little kick to it. It's savory, and it's really, really delicious, and it looks pretty. Like, you could see the grains of mustard in it.
But I also think that's a good representation of what we do. So when we were first baking, we also, most of the stuff, when we say sweet and savory with a touch of spice, it was more verging on the sweeter end of things, and we really wanted to start offering some straight savory options. So we knew cheddar would be a great hit on scones, but just adding the mustard was the twist for us, and you know, also approachable. Not, you know, people know cheddar and mustard sounds good together in a scone. That sounds interesting and new. And it turns out, you know, it's really an amazing and moist and delicious and flaky.
Although scone. I have to say, when I had been experimenting and I threw some mustard in our molasses cookie and I told Erin about it, she was like, no, that's going to be disgusting. And it's actually really good, but people are afraid of it. People are like, oh, I don't know if I should try this. And then they really love it.
It is really good.
Goddamn fear mongers.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I forgot to talk for the past like 5 minutes because I think I saw that rapport that you two must have as co-owners, co-founders of a business, which I think is a very important asset to have, you know, especially trying to, you know, run a business, operate it every day, expand, bounce ideas off each other. How do you guys work together? What is that rapport like?
Well, you know, we started as business partners and not friends, and I think that Agatha and I share some qualities. One of them is, you know, that we're very driven and motivated. So there was never a question as to the work that we were putting in and what we were doing. But I also think that we're very reasonable people. So, you know, we get in our arguments, but there's never been a time where we didn't find a common ground on a decision that we had to make.
And, you know,
and sometimes that has resulted in some heated moments, but we always have been working towards the same goal, which is making Ovenly a success. So we never really, I think both of us never really let our egos get in the way of what we're trying to do with the company.
Yeah. And ultimately we do, like Erin said, find a balance. And I think so much has to do with the fact that we do have a large staff now that is there to help us along the way. In the beginning, it was just us. And I think when we were first starting, I mean, it was just the two of us working our butts off. You know, it was just us. And there were days where we would go a full day without even like speaking two words to each other, just because we were working so hard. And there was never a question about that. There was never a question like, should we keep doing this? What the hell are we doing? This is crazy. And we just continued on. And now, I mean, I think that we're sort of blessed with the fact that it just continues to get easier, not harder. I mean, there's obviously harder business decisions and other challenges to face, but to me, it just seems like it's becoming easier and even more fun and exciting.
Well, we'll take a quick break and come back and talk about what it's like to be $1,000 an hour employee and what tasks, you know, come from that, as well as ridding the world of bad bar snacks.
All right.
You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. We'll be right back.
The following program is brought to you by Rolling Press. Rolling Press is a family-run digital and offset print house that brings together eco-friendly methods, ethical practices, and personalized service. Using environmentally responsible papers, non-toxic inks, and wind power, Rolling Press represents the harmony of traditional craftsmanship and mindful sustainability. Rolling Press offers advice on reducing paper waste and energy consumption, helping you save money and minimize your carbon footprint. For more information, visit rollingpress.com.
This is Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, and you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Hey, and welcome back to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here today with Agatha and Aaron of Ovenly. That's OVEN.LY.
That's the website. The company's just Ovenly, yeah. OVENLY.
Yes. What a quirky website.
Yeah.
$1,000 an hour employee. Tell me what that means to you.
Well, when we have business partners, and they're very, very supportive and amazing businessmen. And one of them, you know, we were, as Agatha mentioned before the break, working, you know, constantly 20 hours a day, truly 18 to 20 hours a day some days. And we were doing everything from washing the dishes to delivering the product to, you know, quality control to baking and mixing. I mean, we truly did everything. And we had a meeting with them one day, and one of our partners said, "You guys have got to stop doing the $10 an hour work because you're a $1,000 an hour employee." And that's kind of been our mantra in the work that we do for the past year or so when we started to professionalize and hire staff. And, you know, it's, we're a small business, so we still do a lot of the $10 an hour work.
We still do delivery sometimes.
But, you know, but we're trying to move into, you know, I think that there's a little bit of a rose-colored glasses for people out there who want to start food companies. It's not just about, it is all about the food, but it's also all about the business. And so if you really want to grow, you have to work towards that $1,000 an hour work. And for us, that's the business growth, business development, recipe testing, recipe combinations, you know, testing the markets for different products. And that's what we're really trying to move towards with the company right now. So,
yeah, I think the way you not only developed your business, but your recipes is there's a base and then there's a build off that base.
Yeah, that's true.
Let's talk about bar snacks, because I remember first seeing you guys with, you know, spicy bacon, caramel corn and maple thyme pecans in bars and at places like the Meat Hook, etc.
Yeah.
Was that the impetus? Was that the beginning? Did you think you were going to do that much more, from cookies to muffins, the brownies, the cakes?
When we first met, we didn't know what Ovenlee was going to be. We there were many renditions to what the business was going to be, and then we decided eventually on the idea of being a gourmet bar snack company, and we felt really good about it. And so we had, you know, developed some of these recipes, and a friend of mine, who we're all friends now, Heather Millstone, she was opening up Veronica People's Club in Greenpoint, and it was going to be a bar, but she was also going to have a cafe during the day and would be selling coffee. And so she said, all right, well, I'll sell your bar snacks. But she also knew that I love to bake and that we are doing a lot of food stuff on the side and baking. And she was like, but you have to make the pastries in the morning. And some of them have to be gluten-free. And at that time in our business, we were saying yes to everything and no to nothing. So we said yes, and Heather picked up our bar snacks, and we also started making pastries. And that's when we first started doing the Baker's Choice pastries. And then another friend was opening up a cafe, and we started selling the pastries there. And then by word of mouth, it just spread. And then we started working with Brooklyn Brewery, who was our third client, and that was a major piece of our business at that time, because we only had three clients, and the bar snacks took off. So at that point, we really felt committed to doing both. We didn't know where it was going to take us. And then eventually the pastries really just took off, and that's what people were demanding. And I think at that time, coffee was, you know, it was being elevated to this really great thing in New York. And there were a lot of great roasters that were, you know, sort of coming up, and a lot of great coffee shops that were opening up at that time. So I think it was just timing that worked out for us. And more people started asking for our pastries. And then we just started delivering pastries everywhere.
Well, let's talk about that Stumptown Shorty, speaking of collaborations. Sure. Yeah.
Well, in terms of the Stumptown Shorty, came about because when we first moved to Red Hook, where our kitchen was in Red Hook for a year, it was on the same block as Stumptown. And the first day that we were down there, we walked down and met Steve Kerbach, who's the head roaster. He's now out in Portland. And he like loaded us up with coffee.
Lots of coffee.
You know, I think like a Chemex and a tea kettle. Like, he gave us everything that we needed to have to make coffee.
And to give context there, Red Hook, it was a very lonely place at that point.
There was
when we were there, we had
there.
No friends. We were just baking in this like industrial refrigerator.
Yeah.
It had no windows, it was completely insulated. So it was freezing in the winter.
Hot in the summer.
And they were our only friends.
So when we saw them, we started talking to them, and we became really good friends with all the guys that were working down there. And so kind of just as an homage to them, we started making this shortbread, and we weren't even selling it. We're like, let's make them a Stumptown shortbread. And we brought it down, I remember, to Steve one day, and he's like, have you talked to Stumptown about selling your stuff? And we were like, no. And he was like, I think you should do that. This is a really good cookie. And we're like, oh, yeah, that's smart. So that's kind of how that happened. It was more just as a thank you. They just kept us caffeinated for an entire year. And then we started making it for them. We don't wholesale that anymore, but you can get it at our shop.
Yeah. So, I mean, talk about other collaborations, the Brooklyn Blackout Cake. You mentioned Brooklyn Brewery, and you use their stout in what is you know, a very infamous cake of Brooklyn itself.
Yeah, I don't even remember what I think. You know, I think what happened is we read there was an article in Edible Brooklyn about the Brooklyn Blackout Cake, and then
we were making salted
pudding buttercream already,
and
it was because of Steve's.
Right, we were making salted pudding, which it's the salted dark chocolate pudding that's bittersweet and salty and delicious, and we were making giant vats of it for Steve's ice cream to add as an inclusion into their ice cream. And so we had a lot left over. We started adding it to the buttercream. And then we also were making the stout cake with salted caramel buttercream. And then we just sort of combined the two flavors together and turned into a blackout
cake. But Steve's did ask us. They were at the time doing a lot of collaborative flavors on their ice creams. They were doing stuff with Salvatore Ricotta and I think even Six Point. And the flavor they wanted was a Brooklyn Blackout ice cream, and we were like, well, if we're going to do that for an ice cream, we should turn the inclusions into a cake.
Absolutely.
So that's how that kind of happened.
Yeah.
And that cake has been a huge hit.
We ship it all over
the country.
Yeah. I remember my father grew up in Brooklyn, and it was Ebinger's.
Ebinger's
Bakery, and they were everywhere. And you can still see a sign somewhere in Sunset or Borough Park of one of the old factories.
Right? Yeah.
But
so, and a lot of bakers do a Brooklyn blackout cake, mm-hmm. and I think they're all different. And I think it's actually really fun that has become so iconic that so many different artisans try to make their own version.
So, I mean, let's talk about iconic, your salty chocolate chip cookie. Did you foresee something as simple as that kind of being the fountainhead of your business?
No,
we didn't foresee any of this.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't have a business plan, so yeah. No, we didn't foresee the cookie. But, you know, that is our all-time. We sell more chocolate chip cookies than we do anything else. But, you know, if you look at it from sort of a macro perspective, who doesn't like a chocolate chip cookie?
Everybody
wants a delicious chocolate chip cookie. And the reason we started making that cookie specifically, you know, it's made with oil, not butter, was because it was simple. Yeah. And we were busy, and a lot of the recipes that we created at the beginning of the company were stuff that we could do in one bowl or like two bowls, and we could do it by hand because we were just...
That's all we were doing. It was by hand.
Yeah. We wanted everything to be easy, few ingredients, and that kind of has still philosophy has sort of driven us. But yeah, I think it's the chocolate chip cookie. If you find a good chocolate chip cookie, I could eat a chocolate chip cookie every day of my life.
We pretty much do eat a chocolate chip cookie every day. And they're great for ice cream sandwiches, and they're great, I don't know, for breakfast, lunch, dinner.
Yeah,
I love them a lot.
I love it. Well, I had two questions. How do you reutilize certain things in your business?
Yeah, that's a good question.
What do you snack on the most? So that kind of answered both of it.
Sure.
Yeah. Right there.
Well, we do reutilize a lot. Like, stuff that we burn, stuff that gets mixed incorrectly, try to make it into something else.
There's a bread pudding recipe in our cookbook that one of our old bakers, Laura, she had come up with because she had screwed up a giant batch of muffins, and we had this muffin batter that we didn't know what to do with, and she was like, I'm going to fix this. I'm going to make this better. And then we had bread pudding for a couple of days, and it was the most incredible bread pudding. So we definitely try to reutilize it and do fun things with it. And it usually works out. Sometimes it doesn't, but most of the time it does.
Yeah, I mean, that's the boring back end stuff you have to think of as a business owner.
Yeah.
Yeah.
From profits and margins, et cetera.
Right. Waste.
So, where does Ovenly go from here? I know it's situated at this beautiful little corner of, of Greenpoint Ave and West Street. The, East River Ferry's there. Buildings are going up. What do you want to be in 5 years?
That's a good question.
So we are currently, we have sort of two sides of our business, and we are working on both. One is that wholesale side. We deliver 365 days a year right now to over 95 different cafes and restaurants and gourmet grocery stores. And that's the side of the business that we want to continue to scale. Figuring that out. That's a whole other,
it's almost a new business
to try to figure out on a large scale, but
it is really two separate businesses because we do have the wholesale and, it's grown so much. And then we have the retail side of it. We have obviously the cafe that you mentioned. And then we are planning on opening up another 1 to 2 locations in the next year. And we do hope to do more and potentially open up on the West Coast. We'd love to continue to partner with other companies as well. And Aaron and I are already brainstorming about a new cookbook.
It's true. I think the big thing too with the retail aspect of it, and even with the wholesale aspect, one of the things that we're also committed to is quality. And we've seen a lot of different companies scale and kind of lose this particular quality. So one of the things that we're trying to figure out right now is how to maintain these pastries that we think are perfect on a large scale. And that is something that we refuse to sort of compromise.
We're very obsessive about quality and quality control.
Yeah.
So speaking of having that control, what isn't on the menu that you hope to have on the menu in the next few years? And let's talk about the menu maker and explain what that is and what's found within it.
The menu maker was a box that was filled. There's a bit about this in the cookbook, filled with recipes that were my grandmother's. And it's actually those two questions go hand in hand. What do we see on the menu in 5 years in the menu maker? Because this cookbook was really an opportunity for Agatha and I to start thinking back on the recipes that we loved growing up, like we talked about. And I have this box and it's imprinted with the words menu maker. And in that box are all the recipes that my grandma either tried or made all the time, from, pineapple cheesecake, which was super 50s, to the walnut kiffle. And
including a recipe that's like chicken for $200.
Chicken alaquin for $500. So, yeah. There's a literally, that's the name of it. But I think that one of the things that Agatha and I are really interested in exploring is the roots of that Eastern European tradition that we come from, because it, I mean, we were talking before the show, it's hard to find bakeries that are really doing it the way that it used to be done. You know, it's that same thing with scale, like really high quality ingredients. And we want to start exploring that a little more and going back to those roots and really kind of playing more with that tradition, I think. So I think that as in the next few years, you're going to see more of that Eastern European influence on our product.
And I think it's very much related to what we're doing now, which is back to, you know, sort of simple ingredients and simple recipes, but playing on tradition in some way. And we really feel connected to our history, our family history. And I think that that is a part of what drives our recipes, but also our business. So I think it'll be really interesting to sort of reconnect with all of that. And, you know, one of the things that we say is our Eastern European determination is what attracted us to each other in the first place. And as business partners, I think that that is a really interesting thing. And that is what drives our business and hopefully our future recipes that we'll be offering.
And we're not bread makers, so we don't really do any yeasted pastries. We don't do viennoiserie like croissants or anything. So, but what we are going to also explore a little bit more are what we can do savory.
Savory.
Besides the scones and some muffins that we do. So we're going to be exploring that as well.
Mm-hmm. The new old world.
Yeah, the new exactly. old world. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, if you haven't stopped by Ovenly, certainly see Agatha and Aaron there. Pick up their cookbook today. And you said 100 plus cafes carry your
about
product.
95, yeah.
Yeah, yep. just keep on asking for it. Keep on spreading it across
tell
the country.
Everyone.
Thank you so much for being on.
Thank
and
you.
Even
Thank
more
you so much.
For bringing delicious
yes.
cookies.
You're welcome.
And tattoos.
And tattoos, which I've applied all over my face right now. You've been listening to The Food Scene on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkell. Hoping to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. Cheers.
Listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.